Welcome to Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. This is episode 29, recorded on the 23rd of April, 2024. And I'm Mark. This week, I've been playing games.
I'm Martin, and I'll be talking about my experiences using the Pantheon desktop.
And hello, I'm Alan, and I've been having more joy with code. This time, Go!
I've been using Pantheon desktop for over a year now, and I'm here to tell you it's better than you think and more customizable than you realize.
That's somewhat damning with faint praise, but okay.
Well, I suppose it is. So let's just sort of scope this. So I've tried multiple versions of elementary OS over the years, from very early versions to current versions. And while I'm good friends with Daniel Foray, who's the project creator, and I really admire their sort of stick to their principles, opinions about how they're going to curate this desktop experience, I find the default configuration of elementary OS a little bit high friction for how I want to use my desktop computer. So I've never really stuck with elementary OS. But, as I say, I've been using Pantheon desktop for over a year now, and I really like it. But that's because it is more configurable than you realize, and when you dig into the configuration that's available, you can really make it something quite different from the default elementary experience, and something that I love.
So, you said it's not like the elementary experience, it's a different experience when you have settings changed. Is that the main driver behind using it? Like, you could probably tweak any of the desktops to be the way you've got Pantheon. Like, what really is the killer thing about Pantheon that means you're not using GNOME or KDE or anything else?
The initial draw, why I started using it, so I'm using Pantheon on top of NixOS, and the real reason I started using it is I got that Z13 ThinkPad laptop, which has an absolutely amazing trackpad. Mm-hmm. And using that trackpad on everything was awful until I installed Pantheon, and the gesture support in Pantheon is sublime, and it turned my laptop into a this is passably good to oh my gosh, this is just like my MacBook level of amazing. And so that was the hook that really drew me in.
I can see why that would be a good thing, because I've often lamented that non-Mac trackpads suck, and yes, the Z13 does have a really nice trackpad.
Yeah.
What sort of gestures does Pantheon support?
The main one that really drew me in is on the Mac, you can have your applications on multiple workspaces and you can do that swiping left and right between your apps. So my sort of workflow for application switching isn't Alt-Tab. It's I have a fixed set of workspaces and each workspace is a task that I'm working on. And being able to flip through those in exactly the same way on Pantheon as I would on a Mac. But also it's tied to your fingers. So it's like turning the page of a book. If you're halfway through that transition and you think, oh, actually, no, I want to go back. It responds precisely to that sudden change of direction and a flick back to where you were. And I suppose it's that tactility, which is really quite addicting.
That's a Wayland thing as opposed to an X or Pantheon thing, because I have the same thing on GNOME. On my Z13, if I swipe left and right, I can hold halfway through the swipe, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So what's interesting is I'm running Pantheon on X11. So this works on X11. Their next version of Pantheon desktop stroke elementary will have Wayland support, which I know has been a big focus for this current release. But everything I've just described has been working on X this whole time.
Oh, well, yeah, I couldn't get with X. It would just flip from one screen to the next. And it wasn't that smooth transition. Okay, what else is killer about your Pantheon setup?
Well, I suppose as we're talking about that sort of, you know, tactility of movement, then the other thing is, like I mentioned, workspaces. One of the things that I've really not been keen on in GNOME and in elementary's default configuration is sort of the dynamic workspaces. And the very fact that that's a deeply configurable thing, and I can turn the dynamic workspaces off and make my static 8 workspaces that are always the same, is kind of key to the way that I use my machine. And it was once I'd found that configuration, it was like, okay, well, this is now very close to what I need to be a sort of productive and familiar setup on my workstation. And then we get into things like the default window controls are different in Pantheon and Elementary, and I have preferences that are different, and that's all configurable. So I'm able to restore the 3 common window controls in the place I expect to find them.
The 3 window controls being set the window on fire, make it rotate as a cube.
And do you have your buttons on the left or the right, sir?
Mine are on the right.
Okay, I'll allow it.
And then I also have it set up so Pantheon has sort of sculpted corners to each of the workspaces, which I'm not a fan of. So you can turn that off. So that's another configuration option that I use. And similarly, the default sort of dock presentation is a bit too glitzy for what I like. And I'm able to configure that tone it down a little
bit. The man who used to use Marty doesn't like glitz.
I know. Who'd have thought shocker, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's some sort of stock things. So the first is, like any desktop, you can apply your own key bindings. I've got key bindings that my muscle memory is just built around. They're not specific to any desktop. It's just the way I've been configuring my stuff for donkey's years, and being able to apply all of that's lovely. The big one is the super key. By default, Pantheon super key works a bit like a long hold, or was it a double alt? I can't remember. What was it in Unity to bring up that? These are all of your key binding menus.
Yeah, that was holding the super key, yeah.
Yeah, long press.
Right. So instead of, if you tap the super key by default, you effectively get a menu overlay of these are your key bindings. Well, if I tap the super key, I want to be able to start searching the menus and launching things. And that is configurable. It's a built-in feature, and I therefore make the super key my searchable launcher.
This doesn't sound too drastic. And is this all configurable, like with G settings and stuff?
Yeah, I think everything I've mentioned so far is all G settings. And so what I also have is, it's very nice with Nix, all of this is declarative and is just a default part of my system. So I never have to go into any of the menus and twiddle these knobs. Some of these settings are available, but they don't have a UI exposed for them, but they're there. So I just have a configuration that applies them all. I suppose the big thing, one of the big things I really have a difference of opinion over with Pantheon, is Pantheon doesn't have support for indicators by default. So indicators are where you would see the Discord chat disappear to. Now, Discord's a poor example because it doesn't do a whole lot, but I have, for example, sync thing indicators and other stuff that sit up there, and many applications disappear up there, like Dropbox.
Nextcloud sync
right
is up there.
Yeah, and the only UI to those applications is via the indicator. Mm. So not having indicator support is a bit of a stumbling block for me, but there are several community projects within the Elementary sort of ecosystem that can provide indicator support. So I use one of those to ensure that indicators work as I would expect them to.
Are there any downsides to using Pantheon?
I don't think so, no. I've been, like I say, I installed it sort of on a whim to get that laptop up and running for a conference when I first bought it. And I loved it so much, I stuck with it. And in fact, at that time, I still had Ubuntu workstations. And I liked it so much, I side-graded my Ubuntu workstations to Elementary before I got round to reinstalling them with NixOS. So I did run Elementary with these same configuration changes for several months as well. I'm really quite smitten with it. I really like it. It's, as I say, if you try Elementary, I can understand why some people would bounce off it and find it maybe a little bit stiff and rigid. But I think it's really worth like looking under the covers and going through the control settings and seeing what's available. There's an additional project, I think it's called Elementary Tweak, doesn't every desktop have a tweak option? Mm-hmm. And that exposes a bunch of additional UI for setting some things. And I've been able to craft this into, in my opinion, the perfect desktop. I absolutely love it.
Cool. I've been continuing my journey of coding joy that I started talking about in episode 25. You may remember, a brief recap, I wanted to just hack on something and I used PHP and just literally hacked on a single piece of PHP running off debug mode or dev mode PHP server. And it was joyous because I could just hack on it and nobody could tell me what to do, man. And I could do whatever I want. And I've had some more joy recently. Over the last couple of weeks, I had an idea to develop an application. And this came out of, I made a snap of a game called The Mirror. And The Mirror is, it's kind of like an open source version of Roblox. The goal is that it's a creative environment in which you build a game within the game, and then you can share that with your friends, much like Roblox, because that's the general thing people do with Roblox. And it's written in Godot, and I snapped it, and that was that done. Then, more recently, somebody open sourced a different game, completely different game, but also written in Godot. And it's called Rota, R-O-T-A. And it's previously been available on Steam and in Itch. And when I saw that it had been open sourced, I thought, huh, I wonder if I could just reuse that config that I've created for The Mirror to snap Rota. And I did. I basically used exactly the same Snapcraft YAML. No difference whatsoever. All I did was change the metadata, the game name, game file name. That's basically it. And packaged it up, tested it, it works, registered the name, and then published it in the store. Now, once I'd done that, I thought, now that I've done that twice with the same config, this feels like a pattern that could be reproduced across a bunch of Godot games, because they all have the same kind of structure. There's a binary executable, and then there's all the assets in another file that sits alongside it. And the Snapgraph configuration is the same because it's, you know, it needs access to a joystick. It might need the network. It needs OpenGL and, you know, all the kind of basic stuff. I thought maybe I could make this reusable. And that's okay if I write a blog post or write some documentation. But one of the problems is game developers are often very time poor and don't really want to learn all the million ways in which to package something. And so I thought, how can I make it easier for Godot game developers to publish their stuff in the Snap Store if they wanted to? And that was the genesis of this thing. How could I make it easier? And so I started thinking, well, these Godot developers, the people developing games using Godot, might not be using Linux. And so installing Snapcraft might be a bit of a pain. Now, Snapcraft is available in various ways. I think it's in Homebrew on a Mac, and I think it's available in other places. But actually, setting up Snapcraft with a VM or remote build or LexD, it's just a faff. And I thought, I'm sure I can make this easier. And so I created a kind of template game with the goal being that I can write a program that allows a game developer to just stuff their game inside this template and then publish it in the store without having to go through a VM, without having to run Snapcraft, without having to do any of the normal build process in a VM. That was the goal.
So, sorry, when you say a template game, you built a game in Godot.
Yeah, like Hello World kind of thing.
Right, and then that's got all of the bits it needs to do. So you can take any game and just put all of the game bits into your framework, and then that can be published very easily.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. And a couple of years ago, I wrote a game in Godot called Little Spy, and I looked at Alan's template, and Little Spy works inside that template just as I would expect. So there's a third sort of reference implementation of this approach.
So where does writing programming in Go come into this?
So think about the people who are developing games might not be using Linux. They might be on Windows or a Mac.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be easier for them if there was just a single binary that they could download, Alan's thing, whatever we call it, and they run that and that does the work. They point it at their game and it does the work that they need to do. And because I can make a cross-platform binary with Go, I can ship a Windows version, a Linux version, and a Mac version, and whatever platform they're on, they just get the binary and they just run it in exactly the same way because it's cross-platform. That's the binary part. And so game developers are quite used to using these command line tools. For example, if you publish a game on itch, they have a tool called Butler. And Butler is the tool that a game developer uses to send their game into itch.io. And so we need a game for Snapcraft, which is like Butler, a single binary that they can just download, run it, and it does everything for them without them having to learn all about Snapcraft and learn all about stage packages and plugs and interfaces and all that nonsense.
So how does your Go application mask the complexity of Snapcraft and its build requirements?
So when you run Snapcraft, it stands up a VM, and then inside that, you've got some configuration that lists a bunch of Debs in the archive, and Snapcraft goes and gets those Debian packages and puts them in the Snap. Now, we already know what those packages are, because I've already got the Snapcraft YAML. So what I did as a test is I just unsquashfs'd a Snap file, because a Snap that's published in the store is just a squashfs compressed file. I just unsquashed it, and just replaced the game that's inside with a different game, and then compress it back up again, install it and run it. That's, in a nutshell, all it needs to do.
So your binary actually contains your whole template?
Yes and no. The problem is some of those Debs get out of date. They get updated in the archive, and so the game publisher will want to publish an up-to-date one, not with versions of, you know, OpenGL from a year ago, a stale build. So there's two parts to this. There's the Go binary that actually does all the building, but then there's also a GitHub action which generates the snap based on my template, and that will be kept up to date. That can run as a GitHub action every day, or maybe not that often, but whenever it's required. And then whenever the Go binary is run, it can check to see if there's a new version by just poking the GitHub API, grab the template, then on the developer's local machine, unpack it, stuff the game in there, pack it back up, and then upload it to the store. That's the goal. That's what I want it to be, as easy as that. So a game developer literally gets a binary, runs it, points it at their game. The binary goes and gets a template from GitHub that's already been pre-built by me. It puts their game inside, adds all the metadata for their game name and the icon and all that kind of stuff, and then publishes it in the store. Now, there's an API for publishing in the store. There's an API for registering your snap in the store. So there's APIs that I'm going to have to leverage in the Snap store. And this is not all complete yet, but that's the goal. And so far, it's got a silly name because Godot is a type of robot. I thought, I need a robot name. So I called it Bender. And so Bender, because we're bending a game to get it into the Snap store, I thought, that'll do. So I made a little repository for my Go software, and I made a separate repository for the Bender template. And the Bender template is the thing that just has a GitHub action that just generates the snap. Now, the interesting thing is, I had a few challenges. Like, there are libraries in Go that can do the squashfs stuff, that can build the squashfs file, but it doesn't look like it's very straightforward to unpack the squashfs file. So what I've done is, in the GitHub action, I build a snap and then I unpack it and then repack it as a zip, because then Go can get the zip file, unzip it, and then put the game in and then pack it back up as a snap. And this has been incredibly joyous for me, and it's all been done inside private Git repos, because I am scared that people will laugh at what I've done so far. And continuing this journey of the joy of code, where I do it without anyone looking at my code or anyone judging me, I can build it all in private in GitHub Actions. And once it's ready, I can then actually make it public.
I approve of this. Do it by yourself in a safe space to keep it joyful. I would also say that undoubtedly this will be of most interest to people that aren't using Linux, that want to stick something in an app store for Linux users. But I can think of an interesting spin on this, which is in the game jams I've participated in, statistically, everyone publishes within the last 5 minutes of the game jam, and it's a massive cram at the end.
Yes.
So if you get this thing built and ready in time for the next Linux game jam, you could drop in and say, hey, you can have publishing your game from day one of your jam, so it's not a last minute panic.
Yeah, I think I'm more targeting the Windows and Mac crowd, to be honest, because I would like them to share their Linux builds with Linux users. I'm currently using the name Bender, but I'm not wedded to that. There are a lot of Benders online, and so I thought maybe someone might come up with a better name than that. And if you do have a better name than Bender, then you know how to get in touch.
I've been playing a game.
Don't ask him. Don't do it. Don't fall for it. He thinks he's got us.
What question are we thinking, listeners?
Yes. You can all call out now.
Come on, Mark. Does it have roguelike elements?
It does.
Is it rogue?
It is not. No, it's not the sort of game you might expect to have roguelike elements. So this is actually a town building game called Against the Storm. And if I was to compare it to anything else, what I would say is, if you liked a real-time strategy game like Age of Empires or Warcraft, not World of Warcraft, the old Warcraft Orcs and Humans game from like DOS, but what you really liked about that game was the base building aspect, where you had to gather resources and build buildings and house all your people before you could build the army and go and smash the other army. That's kind of what this is like. It's like all that, which sounds a bit strange, but it works, basically. There's a lot more to it than just that as you go on, even though it feels a bit like that at first. You know, you're lots of chopping trees and building houses, but then it forms into more of a game from that.
Are you playing this on the Steam Deckaroo or something else?
I am playing it on the Steam Deckaroo, yes. So okay. This is a PC game which works perfectly under Linux.
And it has controller support.
Ah, now that's interesting. So this is the first game I've played on the Steam Deck where I've properly used the touchpad to control a cursor. So basically every other game that I've played, even where it has been one which could use a mouse and keyboard, they've got controller support and you use the two sticks. But this game, you use the touchpad, and it's the first time I've really done that properly on a game where that's the way it's sort of done to use it, rather than I've faffed around. And it works well. I wasn't sure how well the touchpads worked compared to the one on the Steam controller, and it is actually quite nice.
Does it have unlockable tech tree kind of stuff?
Yes, sort of. So the way it works is that each settlement, you basically build a series of settlements, and each time you start off with a few basic buildings that you can build, and you explore the bit of wooded area you're in, but each sort of map that you're deployed onto has different resources available, and you get a different random set of building blueprints each time.
Ah.
And different buildings can produce different things from the resources you gather, or some can produce the same things, but some buildings are more efficient than other buildings.
And what's the purpose of building stuff? Like, are you building defences, or are you just creating a community? What, you know, what's the motivation for doing this?
Yes, Mark, what is the purpose of playing video games?
Well, actually, it's a bit of both in this case. So the way that you win is by scoring what are called reputation points, which are basically sort of victory points. And you can get those in sort of three main ways. One is you can complete an order, which is basically you're given, you know, produce this many of this sort of thing, or discover this many things in so much time or whatever, and that gives you a reputation point. Or you can find challenges around the map, and then completing those, which require resources and time, give you points. And the other thing is your citizens are a random selection of three of a pool of about six races. And if you can make a particular race very happy by fulfilling their needs within your town, then you earn points that way as well. And the idea of the game is to earn enough points before your time runs out. It's kind of like if you played a cooperative war game like Pandemic or something like that. You know, you have win points and lose points, and you've got to get enough win points before you get too many lose points, basically.
So the kind of things you have to collect, I guess one of the classes is dwarf and you have to collect like gold coins or something. Is that the kind of thing?
Sort of. So you have, you have sort of various sort of anthropomorphic animal-based races and humans, and there's basic housing. They all need basic housing. Then there's each sort of race-specific housing. So if you have all of your humans in human housing, then they're happier. And then they have specific kinds of food they like. So if you can make biscuits, that'll make a couple of races happy. If you can make jerky, that makes a couple happy. And some wear clothes. So you want clothes for those who wear clothes. And then they enjoy doing different things. So some enjoy getting drunk, some enjoy fighting. So you have to have buildings for them to do those things in as well.
Did you buy it because it's on special offer at the moment? I notice it's minus 35%. Yes.
I didn't. I bought it because I read about it in PC Gamer and I thought that sounds like exactly the game I want to play at the moment. And I think I probably paid full price for it in that case. But if it's on offer, it's definitely worth getting.
Well, it's on offer the day we're recording this, which ends in 5 days. So it's long gone and you'll just have to save your
If you were psychic, well done.
Yes. It looks like it came out in December last year, and the reviews are very positive recently and all-time overwhelmingly positive. It does look pretty.
Yes.
And it looks like the kind of thing I could waste a day on.
It's not like massively graphically demanding. It's sort of isometric. You're zoomed out for most of it, so it's not hugely detailed, but it is very nice, sort of like colourful environments and nice relaxing music in the background most of the time. But yeah, each sort of settlement takes around about an hour to do. But the reason it's a roguelike is because after every sort of half a dozen or so settlements, the whole map gets washed away and you have to start again.
Oh, nice.
But the experience and some of the points you've gained in the meantime let you then unlock things. And there are ways of making the cycle longer so you can go further and further with your world before it all gets washed away.
So while it's a very different style of game, there's a lot of things you've described here that have me fondly remembering my time playing Rust.
It doesn't look anything like that.
No, I know it won't look like it, but the whole sort of base building and map wiping.
There's sort of, that element to it, which isn't so much like the RTS that I described at the beginning. It is more like, a sort of Minecraft-y, Rusty type game in that respect, yes.
Mm.
I notice also that it's a Windows-only game. They've only published binaries for Windows, but
there
is a little Steam Deck compatibility thing on the Steam homepage that says verified.
Yes. Honestly, if you told me it was native, I'd believe you. Mm-hmm. The only slight caveat with playing it actually on the Steam Deck itself rather than plugged into an external monitor is some of the text is quite small on the small screen. Mm. That's the only slight niggle I have with it in terms of its Steam Deck compatibility. But other than that, it's absolutely flawless, not had any crashes or any other weirdness. So yeah, really good.
And have you also played it on the large screen as well as the internal display?
Yes. Probably about 60% of my playing has been on my TV rather than on the internal display. And it looks really nice. And it's sort of in terms of how it scales up, all the text is then fine to read. It's not like crushed together or anything at that point. So it's quite good. And the colours on my TV really come out with all the environments. Very nice.
So what score out of 5 does this get for Mark? How many dwarves out of 5 does it get?
Well, the equivalent of dwarves in this game, I think, are beavers. They're like the industrious race. So I think this gets 5 beavers.